Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If the teachings and audios you find here at BethEmmanuel.org are a blessing to you, please consider supporting Beth Emmanuel with a gift, or become a member of our virtual congregation by becoming a regular contributor. To learn how to contribute, click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
And this week, we are moving on to Mishpatim, where we read in Exodus Chapter 23, verse 12, these words: 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Sounds redundant from what we were learning last week, doesn't it? On the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. So according to this mitzvah, and this is what we were learning last week, according to this mitzvah, it's incumbent upon a Jew to keep the Sabbath day. And not only that, but he is not to force his domestic animals or domestic servants, his slaves, who by definition are also Jewish. You realize that like a slave of a Jew is also Jewish, because it says the mitzvah is that anyone bought with money or brought into Abraham's household is to be circumcised, right? But in any case, since a Jew is required to circumcise slaves, then he's not to force his slave to work for him on the Sabbath day. That should go without saying. Now, this is not to say that the Sabbath is incumbent and binding, however, on an ox or a donkey. All right. So the ox and donkey, if the ox, you know, is going to do some work on the Sabbath day or whatever, or he like wanders off beyond the Sabbath limits or whatever, you're not going to stone the ox, right, for breaking the Sabbath. And likewise, there's another mention here. This, and it's not a slave, not the slave, but the alien, the stranger. So this is a member of the household, perhaps a member of the household, like a servant that's not Jewish, a non-Jew. So the non-Jew falls into the same category, what I'm implying here, as the ox or the donkey. You can't make the ox or the donkey or the non-Jew work on the Sabbath day. That's a mitzvah incumbent upon a Jew. And as I pointed out last week, this has implications for everyone, at least for believers, for Gentile Christians, as well as Jews. Our master, Melech HaMashiach, the King Messiah, is a Jew. And we are all his servants. In fact, for those of us who are not Jewish, we are his Gentiles. Therefore, since we belong to Messiah, the Sabbath is for all of us. For Jews, of course, as Paul would say, to the Jew first, of course, but also to the Gentile, also for the God-fearing believer. Not for all Gentiles necessarily, but for the Messiah's Gentiles. This does not mean that the Gentile believer is obligated as a Jew to keep the Sabbath. If it did, the apostles would have said so when the question arose about circumcision and Torah. Yes, it's not a requirement, but here's what it is: a privilege. It is a privilege that we have by association with Messiah. It's part of the package of belonging to Yeshua. And this is what we learned last week. Okay, so there's a little bit of review for you. And in the days of the apostles, the Gentile believers, you know, they were celebrating absolutely along with the Jewish believers, one body. And many of them were keeping the Sabbath as a day of rest, not just celebrating the Sabbath, as in, oh, it's the Sabbath, but resting on the Sabbath. There's really no question historically that the Jewish believers were keeping the Sabbath. We have evidence of that, of Jewish believers keeping the Sabbath in the 2nd century, in the 3rd century, the 4th century, and the 5th century. Not in the 6th century. So we don't have any evidence of Jewish believers by the 6th century. But we do have evidence up until the 5th century, ending with Jerome and Epiphanius, these church fathers who say, you know, the problem with these Jewish believers, these Nazarenes and Ebionites. They're just like the rest of the Jews, except that they confess Messiah. They keep the Torah, they keep the Sabbath. Vile heretics. And in the days of the apostles, there wasn't a question about this, but there's this guy named Josephus, this historian who was alive in the days of the apostles, and he observed the situation near the end of the first century. He said, here's the situation, here's what it looks like. This is, I suppose, around 90 Common Era or something like that. He says, there's not any city of the Greeks, nor any of the barbarians, nor any nation whatever where our custom of resting on the seventh day has not come, and by which our fasts and the lighting of lamps and many of our prohibitions as to food are not observed. That's a snapshot from the late apostolic era. Josephus is talking about Gentiles keeping the things of Torah and keeping the Sabbath. He's talking about God-fearers here. And that includes believing God-fearers. They're resting on the seventh day, observing the fast, lighting lamps. It's lighting the Sabbath lamps. Maybe lighting the Hanukkah lamps, I don't know. Observing dietary laws. Emulating the Jewish community. It goes on with some more descriptions about how the Gentiles in all these cities are emulating things of the Jewish people and the Torah, and how the Torah has gone out to all nations. It's a beautiful passage. And this is also the complaint of the apostolic era Roman writer Juvenal. Have you heard of Juvenal? He's a great Roman satirist. And he wrote about the problem, as he saw it, of all these Romans taking on Jewish practice. For example, this is from his Satire 14. He's not sure what's happening here. It sounds to me like he's trying to understand why all these Romans are doing this. But he says, well, some who have had a father who reveres the Sabbath end up worshiping nothing but clouds and the divinity of heavens, and they see no difference between eating swine's flesh, from which their father abstained, and that of man, from cannibalism. And in time, they take to circumcision, which is worse. And all of this is the father's fault, who gave up the seventh day to idleness, keeping it apart from all the concerns of life. So the Sabbath was happening, it was spreading, it was taking, people were noticing all these Sabbath keepers emerging in the late first century. And, you know, the Sabbath is, it's not surprising, it's one of the most repeated commandments in the Bible, which puts it on the important list. Obviously something that's important to God. He mentions the Sabbath more than he mentions the prohibition on adultery. And given that, it seems that it must be important, and it's fairly surprising then to look around today and to realize that most Christians neither observe it, nor celebrate it, nor even remember the Sabbath. The celebration of Sunday has completely eclipsed, supplanted the Sabbath. All right. Not a news flash, I know. Okay, so here's the question. How did this happen? How did we go from the days of the apostles and Josephus and Juvenal to today? I thought it would be interesting for us, since last week I was making the argument for why Gentile believers should at the very least remember the Sabbath and celebrate the Sabbath in some fashion. I thought it might be interesting for us to discover how believers came to revere Sunday as the Christian holy day. And so I thought, you know, that'd be an interesting topic for us to explore today. But it turned out to be a lot bigger topic than I was anticipating. But I pulled a few things together. We'll see how it goes. Okay? So I'd like to start in Acts chapter 20, which is some material that I was working on last week as I was preparing for some writing that I was doing. In Acts chapter 20, we have a depiction of a believing community gathered on the first day of the week, sharing a common meal. So it says in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread. Now, break bread means to eat. It doesn't necessarily imply the Eucharist or something like that. It just means to eat together. It's a Hebrew idiom. So we were gathered together on the first day of the week to break bread, and Paul talked with them, intending to depart the next day. And he prolonged his speech until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered. So oftentimes, those who are defending the first day of the week, Sunday, as the Christian Sabbath, will cite this passage. But the narrative doesn't really support that idea. If Paul was meeting with these believers on a Sunday morning, then he had a very long church service, right? Because he spoke until midnight, right? You guys start to get impatient when I go over half an hour. The Greek text of Acts actually does not indicate that they met on Sunday morning at all. Instead, it literally says on the first of the Sabbath, on the first of the Sabbath, which is idiomatic for the beginning of the week. The Sabbath is over and the new week starts. Everybody says Shavuot Tov, have a good week. At Havdalah time, the separation that happens on Saturday night when the sun goes down. We have another passage that's very similar in 1 Corinthians 16 where Paul says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you also are to do. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up. Shabbat Shekalim, put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so there will be no collecting when I come. So why does Paul, if they're not meeting on the first day of the week, why does Paul tell them to set aside money on the first day of the week? Doesn't this imply that the early believers, already in the days of the book of Acts, have begun to observe the first day of the week as their day of assembly and worship? Well, from a Jewish reading of the passage, it presents no conflict with Sabbath observance, because Sabbath keepers don't handle money on the Sabbath or engage in any kind of financial transactions on the Sabbath. Synagogues do not take collections. You don't pass plates in a synagogue on the Sabbath. So if Paul wants to have a collection of money, he's not going to tell him, on the seventh day, when you come together, bring your money. It doesn't work that way. It's not going to happen. So Paul chose the first day of the week as an appropriate time for setting aside a sum of money, a first fruits, something that should be done at the beginning of the week rather than the end of the week. And it doesn't necessarily imply any sort of assembly in this passage in 1 Corinthians at all. All right, so if Paul's telling him to set, I mean, they could be at home. You could be at home on the first day of the week. Set aside some money. So it doesn't actually mean that you have to meet. But anyway, going back to this Troas issue in Acts chapter 20, when the believers were gathered in Troas, it says, Paul talked with them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his speech until midnight, and there were many lamps in the room. Well, I'd like to suggest, and I know that we've talked about this before in years past, that we have a Havdalah thing going on here, but there's something that I noticed that was interesting as I was putting some of these things together, and with some of the work that Aaron has done on his book on the three meals of the Sabbath, it says that he prolonged his speech until midnight. You see, in ancient times, as well as in some Jewish communities today, Havdalah was followed by a festive meal called the escorting of the queen, Malava Malka. The escorting of the queen, it's like a fourth meal, or an extension of the third meal, right after the Sabbath. The Talmud says a man should always set his table after the Sabbath, even though he only needs a little morsel of food. So in other words, even if he's not even hungry, he should at least set his table and have this fourth meal after the Sabbath. And according to tradition, this meal is called the Meal of David, King Messiah. And the tradition says that David asked God to reveal to him on what day he would die. And God revealed to him that he would die on the Sabbath. And so from that day on, every time he came to an end of the Sabbath and he was still alive, he had a special Thanksgiving meal to thank God for another week that he had made it. So the meal of King David, the meal of King Messiah. This associated with, it has some associations with these messianic themes, these Davidic themes. And the meal is supposed to be eaten after the Sabbath, like I said, but some Hasidic rabbis who would teach their disciples at these meals, they would delay the meal, prolong it, actually, as long as possible in order to preserve the spirit of the Sabbath into the week and sanctify a little bit of the week with the holiness of the Sabbath. But the Halakha says you have to eat it by midnight. Otherwise, it's no longer the this fourth meal, this meal of the Sabbath queen. And this accords with what we read here, that Paul prolonged the meal till midnight. Then it gets interrupted because Eutychus falls out the window and he has to go and pick up Eutychus and bring him back upstairs. But then it says, then they ate their meal. They sit down and they eat. They break bread. And then Paul keeps talking until daybreak. That's what it says. But so anyway, this fits very, very nicely. This fits this tradition of this Havdalah, fourth meal, Malav Melka, the meal of escorting the queen, fits very nicely with this gathering together of the believers on the first day. And it makes complete sense that the believers would gather at this time. Because if you think about it, it's not always convenient to gather on the Sabbath, especially if you're trying to keep the Sabbath with the full halakha. If, as an assembly, we were all keeping the Sabbath halakhically, legally, according to Jewish law, most of us would not be here right now because we could not drive here, right? And dozens of other issues involved. It's actually much easier to gather when the Sabbath is over. In addition, a lot of times the early believers didn't have their own synagogue. They were like a Bible study group in a larger synagogue. So they would go to the synagogue, and they would hear the Torah, they hear the scriptures read, and then they would gather together after the synagogue services and perhaps after the Sabbath, and they would talk about the things of the Master. In addition, there is a connection to the resurrection, because the resurrection, as we read in Matthew chapter 28, the resurrection was timed to have occurred at the end of the Sabbath. We always think that the resurrection happened on Sunday morning, but it doesn't say that anywhere in the Gospels. It only says that the tomb, the empty tomb, was discovered Sunday morning. But as for the time of the resurrection, Saturday night, after the Sabbath, is what it says. So, I sometimes wonder if I'm just making stuff up. And then, once in a while, I find someone who agrees with me. And in this case, it was Raymond Brown. Now, this is really exciting, because Raymond Brown, there aren't many names bigger in gospel scholarship than Raymond Brown. Now listen to what Raymond Brown says on this passage. He says, the association of Sunday and the resurrection was a secondary development. Originally, on Saturday evening, after the close of the Sabbath, around 6 p.m., and thus, by Jewish reckoning on what was already Sunday, Jewish Christians who had observed the Sabbath now met at their homes to break the Eucharistic bread as a prolongation of the Sabbath. He said prolongation. Well, that's as Paul prolonged his talk, as a prolongation of the Sabbath. Thus, it would seem that the earliest Christian celebrations on the first day of the week were not on the day of Sunday, but late in the evening on the vigil of Sunday. So, our theory, me and Ray, our theory is that the believers originally revered the first day of the week as a conclusion to the Sabbath, which they celebrated with a special commemorative meal in memory of the Master's resurrection. And there's actually some evidence for this in the Talmud. According to the Talmud, the Nazarenes in the Apostolic era, and by Nazarenes we mean Jewish believers, in the Apostolic era, in the days while the temple was still standing, the Nazarenes, according to the Talmud, revered the first day of the week as a day on which you should not fast. That's all it says. That it was a day on which you shouldn't fast. This is really interesting because we have, from the first century, there's a scroll called the Scroll of Fasts. And in this scroll are all these different dates when you shouldn't fast. You shouldn't undertake a personal fast. Because this is the anniversary of such and such a miracle that happened. This is the anniversary of such and such a thing that happened. And then there's other dates when you when it's appropriate to fast. Because this is the anniversary of when the walls were breached. And this is the anniversary of when something awful happened. So this is something that was a concern in first century Halakha. Was like, is this an appropriate day to fast or not? And so according to the Talmud, it wasn't just the Nazarenes, but the whole community the whole Second Temple community did not fast on the first day out of deference for the opinion of the Nazarenes. Now, why would that be? Well, they're commemorating a big miracle that happened on the first day of the week. So here's my point. In the days of the apostles, the first day of the week was honored as a special day. It was a there was some sanctity to it. There was something to be celebrated. And how did you celebrate it? Well, you gathered after the Sabbath and you got together and with some friends and you had a third meal or a fourth meal, or your third meal became your fourth meal, and you did Havdalah, and then you talked about the things of the Master. The Didache supports this first century document. It says it this way. It says, every Lord's Day, Sunday, first day, every Lord's Day, gather yourselves together and break bread and give thanksgiving. After having confessed your transgressions, that your sacrifice may be pure. Which is not something that, you know, because confession is not something associated with Sabbath. You don't stand on Sabbath and strike your chest and confess your sins. But it's something that would be very appropriate for the first day. So, as we enter the second century, things have begun to change rapidly. As you know, Gentile Christianity was in a big hurry to disassociate itself from Judaism. The Jewish wars were going on, and there's a general anti-Jewish sentiment that has risen among, certainly among Roman society, and also among Gentile believers. And then there's Martian, the heretic, you know, Martian. He's trying to tear Judaism out of Christianity. Very popular fellow, Martian, teaching Gnosticism. And then there's the Epistle of Barnabas that's circulating around, which is an apocryphal epistle, and it's really anti-Jewish, don't, you know, it's anti-Torah. But if we read in the Epistle of Barnabas, I wish I could sustain your attention span long enough to read the whole passage, but it's not possible. It's too long. It's too long with too many, and thus it's written, and thus and therefore, and that sort of thing. But in the Epistle of Barnabas, chapter 15, it talks about the Sabbath. And it says, there's actually this very nice apostolic era midrash that's about the Sabbath, that's brought in, where it's that whole thing about the day of the Lord. A day is as a thousand years are as a day. There will be 6,000 years and then a 1,000-year Sabbath rest of the days of Messiah and this sort of thing. It's all here. It's all very nice. Then it talks about how, you know, we can't properly keep the Sabbath until the kingdom when we'll be sanctified. But it uses this argument to say, so you see, the Sabbath's not really such a big deal. And it ends, the passage ends saying, wherefore also we keep the eighth day with joyfulness. the day on which Jesus rose again from the dead. And when he had manifested himself, he ascended into the heavens. So, according to Barnabas, on the eighth day, which is the same as the first day, that's what's more appropriate for us as believers to keep. He doesn't say we don't keep the Sabbath in Barnabas. It de-emphasizes the Sabbath. And it tries to emphasize the first day, eighth day. It's a very subtle little shift in emphasis happening. Then there's Ignatius. You know, Ignatius, he's over in Antioch in the second century, early second century, bishop of Antioch. And he's writing an epistle. He thinks he's Paul. Ignatius, he is. He's like, who is this guy? He's sitting in Antioch sending epistles to all these different congregations. Like, you know, he thinks he's an apostle. But he's sitting over there in Antioch, and he's writing this epistle to the Magnesians, because apparently he's heard that the Magnesians are still resting on the Sabbath. And so he writes to them, he says, "Let us therefore no longer keep the Sabbath after the Jewish manner and rejoice in days of idleness. For he that does not work, let him not eat." So in other words, if you're not working 7 days, you don't eat. "For thus says the Holy Scriptures, in the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat thy bread. But let every one of you keep the Sabbath after a spiritual manner." What does that mean? Well, he explains, "rejoicing in meditation on the law." So thinking about the Torah, talking about Torah, learning Torah. "Not in the relaxation of the body, but in admiring the workmanship of God." So he's saying, don't literally take the day off. Study Torah, learn some Torah, go outside, look at creation, enjoy, you know, that in 6 days God made the heavens and the earth. On the seventh day, he rested. He says, admiring the workmanship of God, not eating things prepared the day before, nor using lukewarm drinks. That's what it says. It's talking about our coffee. "Nor walking within a prescribed space," you know, the Sabbath limit. "Nor finding delight in dancing and plaudits," I don't know what a plaudit is, "which have no sense in them. And after this," and now here, catch this. I never noticed this before. He says, "and after the observance of the Sabbath, let every friend of Christ keep the Lord's day as a festival." So the thing is that Ignatius, even though Ignatius is the guy who's trying to like suppress the practice of Torah in the church, he is nevertheless saying, keep the Sabbath, just, you know, do it like this. Don't literally keep the Sabbath. Just, you know, just think about the Torah and stuff and look at the stars or something. And then he says, "and after the Sabbath, then, if you're a friend of Christ, keep the Lord's day as a festival, the resurrection day, the queen and chief of all the days of the week." Now, yeah, because the Sabbath in Judaism is called the queen of the days. So you see the shift that's taking place. Anyway, this is very early. These words are astonishing to me because even though Ignatius is anti-Torah and he's anti-Judaism and he doesn't want to, he doesn't try to get the Magnesians to quit honoring the Sabbath. He knows that that's not even a thought to him, is that Christians wouldn't honor the Sabbath in some way. He's trying to get them to change the way that they're honoring the Sabbath, to use it for a time to meditate on Torah and creation and so on. After the observance of the Sabbath, though, the real queen, the first day of the week. So you see this shift that's happening. It's not all at once. It's kind of subtle. He's diminishing the Sabbath, getting the believers to step back from the Sabbath, but he's not completely dismissing the Sabbath. So it's not as if Gentile Christians one day all suddenly said, "Hey, you know what? Enough with this Saturday stuff. From now on, we're worshiping on Sunday." It happened slowly, and for a very long time, Christians were observing two holy days, Sabbath and Sunday. We know that Sunday morning, by the second century, we had started seeing services on Sunday morning. Even the end of the first century, Pliny the Younger talks about torturing believers, and he's wondering about, you know, if it's really necessary to kill them all, so he writes to the emperor to ask. And he says, this is what he's learned from them. They get up early on the first day of the week, and they say some prayers, and then they break bread, and then they go to work. That was your Sunday morning service. End of the first century, beginning of the second century. Justin Martyr is talking about it too. Says we get together, we read the memoirs of the apostles on Sunday morning. We have the Eucharist and this sort of thing. Anyway, I thought this was surprising. To me, this was surprising to realize both days were around for a long time. How long? Well, we have the apostolic constitutions. In the 3rd century, this is preserved in Eastern Christianity, apostolic constitutions say, keep the Sabbath. That's Christian law. Keep the Sabbath and the Lord's Day, because the former is a memorial of creation and the latter, the resurrection. 3rd century Christian document. And it goes on to say in another of its laws, let slaves work 5 days, but on the Sabbath day and the Lord's day, let them have leisure. Because we have said that the Sabbath is an account of creation and the Lord's day of the resurrection. And we know that the Gentile believers were still keeping the Sabbath, even, not all of them, but some, were still keeping the Sabbath, even in the 4th century, when the Council of Laodicea met to discuss the problem. Because at the Council of Laodicea, we find the smoking gun, I think, in the canons released from the Council of Laodicea. Canon number 16 says, first of all, the Gospels are to be read on the Sabbath with the other scriptures. Why would you have to say that? Because the Gospels apparently weren't being read on the Sabbath with the other scriptures, which implies that perhaps the Torah and the Haftarah are being read on the Sabbath and the Gospels are being read on the Lord's Day. I don't know, just a possibility. Here's canon number 49. During Lent, the bread must not be offered except on the Sabbath day and the Lord's Day only. So you see, we're still honoring both days. Here's canon number 51. The nativities of martyrs, births of martyrs, are not to be celebrated in Lent, but commemorations of the holy martyrs are to be made on Sabbaths and on the Lord's Day. And here's the smoking gun that I mentioned. This is the first place that I know of, maybe there's others, but this is the first place that I know of that it says that if a Gentile Christian actually rests on the Sabbath, he is to be excommunicated. It's canon number 29. Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's day, and, if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ, cut off from Christ. So, the meaning of the council, what the decision that the council came to was we're dealing with a Christianity that honors both these days as holy in some way, rests on the Sabbath. Not everyone, I'm sure, but some Christians are still resting on the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath. And the council says, we want to change that. We want to move the rest over to the Lord's Day, the first day. All right, and so this 4th century council, you know, from here on out, we have Sunday being thought of in Christian development as the day of rest, the Christian Sabbath. There you go. That was our little journey through history to figure out how did this happen? It took centuries, actually, to make the full transition. It took, as far as I can see, about 4 centuries to wean Christians slowly off of the Sabbath. And since then, there's been, you know, there's occasional holdout groups here and there, these little goofball communities that are are Sabbatarian and keep the Sabbath and that sort of thing. But for the most part, since then, no, Christians don't keep the seventh day. They don't keep the Sabbath, regardless of what it says in the Bible. All right, so there's much more to this story. I'm only giving you a few highlights. I thought you would enjoy it. I thought you'd enjoy learning a little bit about the origin of Sunday as the Christian holy day and how Christianity lost the Sabbath. And it's a little bit of reflection on who we are at Beth Emmanuel. God has given us, I believe, a special calling. A real special thing in that we're... It's not so special to be Sabbatarian. You know, a lot of people are Sabbatarian. Seventh-day Adventists are Sabbatarian. Worldwide Church of God is Sabbatarian. As far as I know, we are one of the few Sabbatarian groups, and I mean us, inside here right now. I mean us. We are one of the few Sabbatarian groups to bring the Sabbath perspective, to bring the Sabbath from within Messianic Judaism, from a Jewish perspective, without the mandate of one law obligation on all Gentiles behind it. This is a really, really unique niche. We can present the Sabbath to our brothers and sisters in the church, in Christianity, without forcing it down their throats and without condemning them for reverencing Sunday. Every other Sabbatarian group I know of condemns Sunday as, you know, oh, the sun worship day or something like this. You know, it absolutely condemns Sunday and the fact that Christians worship on Sunday. But look, from a Jewish perspective, what day is the day of worship? Every day. Shacharit, Mincha, Mariv. Shacharit, Mincha, Mariv. Shacharit, Mincha, Mariv. 3 times a day. Every day. There's no problem with worshiping on Sunday. And from a Messianic Jewish perspective, we should have the honesty to look at the sources and say, look, Sunday as a first day, even though it's Saturday night, whatever is Saturday night, this is something that was being respected, something that was being honored as early as the apostolic era. So who are we to throw stones at people for, you know, worshiping God on Sunday? I don't know of any other Sabbatarian group that's saying that. Do you? I don't. But nevertheless, we have the Sabbath to give back to our brothers and sisters and say, look, I think you lost this. We found it. This belongs to you. And this is a mission. It's like the Blues Brothers. We're on a mission from God. It's a calling. We're not only called to enjoy the holiness of the Sabbath and enter to its rest ourselves and then lay around and then say, isn't this great? We're so holy, so blessed. But we are to share this with our brothers and sisters in the church. Our master says, freely you have received, freely give. We are on a mission to restore the Sabbath to the church. And when I say the Sabbath, I mean the Jewish Sabbath. Because yes, there's other types of Sabbatarian Christians, there's Adventists, but their approach to the Sabbath has not been through Judaism. It's been anti-Jewish, if anything. And the Sabbath belongs to Israel. It is a gateway. It's a gateway to Messianic Judaism. It's not up to us to to define what Sabbath means, I think we've fought that battle already. There is a people that have been wardens and keepers of the Sabbath for 3,400 years now. And we have that perspective. It's time for us to bring this blessing forward. Do you believe that the Sabbath is a day of blessing? Do you believe that it is a day of holiness? Then let's do something about it.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.